Falls Sie dann einen mal ein
Paul.
Three words: direction, belonging, contribution. These three are some of the most basic requirements for a healthy, hopeful living. Without direction, we can be aimless. Without belonging, we can just shrivel and be isolated. And without contribution, we can just be listless. Most, if not all of us, I think, want a clear destiny, a direction, a target to aim for in life. That's direction. And, of course, we want connection. We want affinities. We want, some comrades along the way to the destination, and that is belonging. And also, we need to make a difference, to leave a mark, to have a significant role to play, and that's contribution. Who has watched the Kony 2012 video? Okay. Yep, so probably about 60%. I think communication students are probably sick of talking to death about this in tutorials already, but here you go, here's mine. There's much more to the phenomenon than this, but I think the video tells a captivating story that offers a clear direction, a sense of belonging, and a way to contribute. So the clear direction is, make Kony famous, have him arrested, bring justice, even make change world history, I think was a line used. It offers belonging. You can wear the bracelet. You can stand with the invisible children. And also, it offers contribution. Ways to leave your mark. By sharing the video, donating to Try, leafleting on the 20th of April. It's got the lot. And so it's quite compelling. And the fact that in just 2 weeks, yesterday, American time, it's been shared over 83 million times, kind of echoes the hope within the script of Kony 2012. It's kind of resonating with our generation. I think we do have a bit of a crisis in our generation, in our society, a crisis of hope. A spiritual vacuum is a significant contributor to the problems we face, probably even basic to them. And so I ask you to engage tonight with a cautious but inquiring mind of the hope found in Jesus. I say cautious because I want you to believe in truth and therefore to be properly convinced of this stuff. What the Apostle Peter is writing here in the Bible is nothing less than of the hope found in Jesus by a clear and purposeful direction in life rather than a dead end. Secondly, it holds out participation in this deep and abiding fellowship, true belonging, rather than an isolated life. And then thirdly, it means contribution to a significant task rather than menial trivialities. Three words: direction, belonging, contribution. Three basic building blocks to hope, all found in Jesus. So first of all, direction. Look with me at verse 17. Since you call on a Father who judges each person's work impartially, live out your time as foreigners here in reverent fear. Here we see all the direction needed to have a clear purpose in life. Live for an audience of one. That's what he's saying. Don't live for 1,000 different desires and pressures. Be directed by just the one. And if you were just to have one clear direction in life, you'd want to make that one a pretty weighty, substantial, worth it kind of purpose, wouldn't you? And the one for Christians is none other than God, his pleasures and desires. In the original setting, Peter is asking these tiny, tiny Christian communities that he's writing to keep the biggest picture in perspective. Your life is answerable to God. So live in awe of him. Don't let the fears of being this small and unheard of group control you. Don't let the perceptions of how people, you know, treat you as foreigners now that you're a Christian, even in your own village, who think that you're maybe even a deviant community within society. Don't let those fears toss you back and forth every which way. There is a bigger power that you need that overrules your conduct. Live in reverent fear of God, the Father, who will judge each person's work impartially, including, of course, those who have no reverence for him at all, those who are making your life difficult. That's the clear direction. An audience of one. And that's probably all you need, in global view at least, even if the details need to be worked out. And now the motivation for this directedness. And here it is. This one that you live for gave you everything. Verse 18. For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. He was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. This one that you live for, he redeemed you. Ransomed is another word for it. He bought you out of slavery to futility, not with money, silver and gold, a commodity that comes and goes. No, with a priceless payment. The precious Lamb of God, Jesus Christ. It's easy to give yourself to someone who's so loving, isn't it? In fact, this grace, such favour, is so powerful, so motivating, that it turns even the fear of God from something extrinsic to something self-generating. Why live in fear of God? Well, because he will judge everyone impartially, yes. But for Christians, for the ransomed, even more so, because in Jesus, and particularly his death, God gave everything for us. In other words, living for the audience of one is internally compelling if you grasp God's undeserved kindness to you. Because, of course, you don't want to take his priceless gift for granted. Even though he was eternally precious to God, Jesus appeared on earth for our sake, and that is something for which, if you've grasped it, it grasps you right back. So that you never ever want to yell to God, sucked in God, you gave everything for me, now I'll just live for myself. So we have the direction and we have the motivation for it. And here now is the support. It rests on Jesus' resurrection. Verse 21. Through him you believe in God who raised Jesus from the dead and glorified him, so your faith and hope are in God. There's a rock-bottom reason to hope in God, to live for God, and that is that Jesus rose from death with a glorious, immortal, death-defeating body. It was God's way of saying that Jesus' death on the cross was all satisfying to him, that it accomplished its redemptive task. The empty tomb of Easter is God's tick, exclamation mark, over the ransom price Jesus paid on the cross to release us from sin and death, and therefore from ultimate futility. You see, this is the support for all of this. This is the rock bottom evidence. Jesus' resurrection changes. It makes all the difference. It turns these words of Peter's, the whole Bible, in fact, from, I don't know, just a good read, inspiring poetry, to blood and bone reality. What we're talking about today is not just nice ideas. If the resurrection of Jesus didn't happen, then Christians of all people are to be pitied, as deluded, as pathetic. So I'm not asking you to star rate this talk out of 5 like YouTube. That is not the nature of the topic today. This is either the most fundamental, great announcement, life-changing news that can ever be made, deserving your full-on wrestling to work out whether it's true, to prove it in your life, or it's a waste of my time, not to mention yours. Now, if you're unsure of this proof, this evidence of Jesus' resurrection, you're still exploring, then can I suggest that you proceed to the next 2 points of this talk, belonging and contribution, with a hypothesis that is looking for confirmation kind of attitude. The hypothesis includes these set of assumptions: that God exists, that God loves his world that has fallen into futility, that God sent his son to ransom this world with the cost of his blood, and that God was pleased with that payment and raised Jesus to life again. So now, given those set of assumptions, what can we expect? Let's see if it coheres. Well, given those set of assumptions, we might expect that God would form a new community around this raised Jesus. Do you think, given the assumptions, that might be good to test? Well, that's where Peter goes. The second big point, belonging. Verse 22. Where is it? Here we go. Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth, so that you have sincere love for each other, love one another deeply from the heart. For you have been born again, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable, through the living and enduring word of God. For all people are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of the Lord endures forever. And this is the word that was preached to you. Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good. Peter uses lots of imagery here, and some of it's quite mind-blowing. It's a feast that we probably won't be able to fully enjoy, but let's give it a crack. So, back to verse 22. He says that the word of truth, and for some of you, I know that's still a hypothesis at this stage, but for others of you, you've accepted it, and he says you've obeyed it. You believe the great announcement of God's grace to you in Jesus' blood ransom. And if that's you, it's purified you. You have purified yourself by obeying the truth, by accepting God's great announcement of Jesus' blood ransom. And that word, purify, it means, in other words, that Jesus' death really has made you clean with God. When you obey this great announcement, it makes you acceptable with God. God now treats you like he treated Jesus after death. He vindicated him. He said, yes, Jesus, thank you, Jesus. He raised him. Come on home, Jesus. And that's for us too, as we obey the truth. You know, he says, you're accepted. You belong, you see. You're at home with God now because you've been ransomed by Jesus. He says a similar thing, though maybe even using more stark language, in the next verse and following. He says, this word from God, this truth, this great announcement of Jesus' blood ransom for you is God's imperishable seed that has been implanted into you. And so you are no longer now a lifeless egg, but a full-on embryo, a newborn, a new life. He goes on because Peter loves a word picture. Instead of being like normal grass, which is glorious but perishes, you are like indestructible grass because you've been planted by the gospel seed. You belong to God in a whole new way. Not just is he your creator, but he's your father. You belong in the family of God forever. To be born of God means belonging with him as your father, to rely off and live off his word, to crave the milk that he nourishes you with. But of course, it means more than that. It also means that you have siblings, brothers and sisters. And that's especially evident in verse 22, although the translation masks it. Verse 22, now that you've purified yourselves by obeying the truth so that you have sincere love for each other, and that each other there is literally the siblings word, the adelphoi, the brethren, it's a family type word, then love one another deeply from the heart. Now, it sounds like he's saying the same thing twice, doesn't it, to love each other. But he's actually saying two things. The first one is it's kind of the consequence clause, the result clause. So it's going like this. You've purified yourself by obeying the truth into a sincere love for the brethren. So, love each other deeply from the heart. Since you have sincere love for the brethren, that's what you've been born into, then go on to love one another deeply from the heart. There's a Credo member called Mark. He was having a lecture break from a three-hour lecture, going down to the cafeteria, I believe, to get some refreshment with his classmate. And as they're walking past the concourse, they go past this group of people sitting there. And they were a Credo group. And Mark knew this, but his friend said to Mark, that's a bunch of Christians. And Mark plays along, knowing full well they are, but he goes, yeah, how do you know? Oh, because they were wearing polo fleece. And, you know, some of them were. Bart says, oh, okay, yeah, anything else? And he goes, they're a mixed group, guys and girls. And they're multiracial. Oh, okay, yeah. And they're not studying. Oh, why is that important? Well, because you'd expect that in a group work, Simon, but they're not studying. They're not doing, you know, and it looks like they might even be multi-year and multi-faculty. They've got to be Christians. There's a very obvious application here. If you're a Christian, the fact that you belong in God's family means that you can never, ever come along to a public meeting, to your Credo small group, to your church, simply for you to be inspired, or for you to learn more, or for you to be informed. You're not part of a crowd as a Christian. You belong in the family of God. You are a participant, not a spectator. No, you come along to express your sincere love of the family. That's what you're born into. And so, you seek to do it deeply, from the heart, to cement yourself relationally with others. This means very concrete behavioural action in your relationships. Things like, verse 1, ridding yourself of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy and slander of every kind. All those things which tear at relationships, which hurt and scar and destroy brothers and sisters. But also, of course, like the opposite to that list, being open and vulnerable with brothers and sisters and transparent even about your difficulties and struggles means encouraging others and valuing the contribution and presence even of others, expressing appreciation and warmth to newcomers amidst your Christian circle, because it's not your Christian circle, it's God's family. Here is another thing this belonging means. When you have cleanness before and welcome with God, when you've been purified, you know that you're accepted and forgiven with Him, you belong utterly to Him through Jesus' paid ransom. And so you do not need to prove yourself or bolster your self-image through others. This is the difference Jesus makes to true belonging. See, many people relate, they join a group, whatever, to get some sort of boost, to prove themselves to others and maybe even to themselves. They belong in order to be okay. That's different to the belonging that Jesus gives us. We're okay, so we belong, you see. It's different. And when you relate in order to belong, what that does is it turns people, the others, into a means for your end. When you belong to God, it's only because He made you belong to Him and His family. You didn't earn it, you didn't prove yourself. And so suddenly there's no need to prove yourself to others either. You can start to really listen in conversations. Be interested in the person. Instead of kind of finding ways for you to make yourself look good in the conversation. You can start to appreciate others just for who they are, rather than for what they reflect onto you. You can stick with groups or friends or that bring no kudos to you instead of dumping them. And you certainly don't get embarrassed when a social pleb sit next to you in class, because God's not embarrassed to have you in His family. Is the gospel the great announcement of God's undeserved kindness and favour to you through Jesus' blood ransom, is that making you a kinder, gentler, more patient, more accepting, and less using of those around you type person? Because if it is grasping you, it will. Verse 2, like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you will grow up in your salvation, now that you've tasted that the Lord is good. Third word, contribution. This third matter underlying hope-filled life is contribution. And Peter addresses it in verses 4 to 10. And just a warning here, if you found the ideas and the visual imagery of the previous paragraphs a bit of a bundle, then nearly every word and every sentence, every phrase is now just rich with allusion and deep background. So what I'm going to do is a little bit weird. I'm going to revert now into explaining 4 to 10 backwards. It's the simplest way I can think of explaining this. But basically, Peter alludes to or tells two different stories, and he merges them into a composite picture to make a really significant point about contribution. One narrative is historical, and it's pretty much the story of the Old Testament, especially the history of Israel. It's referred to in verses 9 to 10. I told you we're starting at the end. But you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. This is alluding to the narrative of God's dealing with Israel from the time of her exodus from Egypt. God, the Lord of all nations, ransomed out of slavery a household really, and they're called Israel. Israel was precious because out of all the families of the earth, they were to be holy to God, dedicated to him and his ways. The words here, verses 9 and 10, are from their commissioning as a nation at Mount Sinai after they'd been rescued out of Egypt. Their role was to be a light in the world so that they could draw others to God like a moth to light. Israel's living, Israel's working, Israel's community, Israel's ways, Israel's worship, they were all to be an alternative household in the world, serving the world by being the place in all the world where God dwelt amongst people. And so being a delight, a blessing to all who inhabit God's world. In other words, they were to be a priestly kingdom. They were a kingdom, but priestly. They were for the others in all their ways. And all their ways were like sacrifices to God, pointing people to God. That's one story. The story has a problem. The problem is that as you read through the rest of the Old Testament, Israel turned her back on God and became just like all the other surrounding nations. And so God's purpose for her remained unfulfilled. Right, you got that story? Here's the second story. The second narrative is about a stone. And I wonder if you can detect the similarities and differences with the first story I told you. This story is figurative and it's based on some prophecies in the Old Testament, and it's referred to in verses 6 to 8, and here's a paraphrase for you. God in this story is not now the Lord of the nations, but he's an architect. And he's an architect of a massive building in the centre of the world, Zion, and he's chosen this stone, maybe, you know, from a quarry or whatever. To him it's very precious. He's chosen it carefully for a very special reason. This stone will do a lot of good for a lot of people. It will be God's way of blessing the world. The problem is that the other labourers on the building site, they don't like this stone. They trip over it. It gets in the way. They don't like the look of it. They don't see why it's so special. And so they throw it in the dumpster. But God, being the architect, he gets the stone the builders rejected, and he makes it the cornerstone of the entire building. This stone ends up bringing great delight and blessing to all who use and inhabit God's building. Precious stone of God, priestly nation of God. Do you see how the two stories go together? The stone is the promised perfect Israel, the fulfilled Israel, the complete Israel, the Israel who truly is a blessing to the whole world. It's Jesus. The stone is the one who comes from God to complete Israel's role in the world. But just as Israel had previously turned their back on God before, so they stumbled on this new work of God and dumped Jesus in the skip bin. But undeterred, God actually rescued this stone and made this living stone the chief stone of a new house of God. A building of true blessing and delight and service to the world. A household where priests would offer spiritual sacrifices to God, making Israel's original role in the world, verses 9 and 10, actually come true through people like us. How does that happen? Well, it happens by people like us coming to the complete Israel, the true Israel. And here is where the stories merge, verses 4 and 5. But as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. As people entrust themselves to Jesus, the living stone, and keep doing that, it's a present continuous, it's come to him always type verb, they continually get built into a house of blessing, the building of delight for all the world, the kingdom of priests. See, the community, the house where Jesus is the chief cornerstone of our lives, he is what we build our identity on. And so we offer all of our work and every part of our lives to his glory as spiritual sacrifices for the sake of the world. Okay, long way around about to say this. The amazing contribution that Christians get to make because of Jesus is to mediate or distribute God's presence in the world. By lots of little Christian communities that are building their life on the cornerstone and making every part of their life a sacrifice to God, spread throughout all the world. The task for us, the mark that we make in the world, is to serve the world as God's priests. So Peter is continuing the theme of direction here, isn't he? It's all about one direction, building your life on one, the cornerstone. Because that's how you honour God. And he continues with the theme of belonging as well, because being in God's family through Jesus is about being a holy priesthood, a royal people. But in this last section, he's also very importantly about contribution. That you corporately may declare God's praises and mediate God's presence in the world together. Corporately. Our very relating together as Christians says something powerful and transformative to those around us. And our individual jobs and tasks and lives get caught up into this purpose as well. The Christian doesn't study ultimately for themselves, the Christian uni student. No, they study for others. To serve the world. And because it's God's world, as they serve the world, they're living for the audience of one. And so, your studies, your work, your pleasure can all be done for God as a spiritual sacrifice. And this kind of adds something to what I was saying before about how we belong to our Christian communities. We never go to spectate, we go as participants, but we also go as contributors. See, many people are used to operating in life by segregating belonging, their social life, from their contribution, their job. These are often very different spheres for people. But when you have a God direction in life, he integrates all parts of your life. So belonging to him and his people and contributing to God's purposes in the world go together. And that means as you grow as a living stone into the way God is rebuilding the world through Christ, you can never again come to Credo Public Meeting or small group or your church just to express your love of the brethren. You must also go to contribute to God's task in the world as well. And so that means things like looking out for those who are just learning, bringing those who are just learning, coming to hear perhaps people for the first time, God's glory is declared. And to help them understand it. So you come as a participant in the family of God and as a contributor to the way God is using his holy nation, his people, his royal priests in the society in which they are located. Okay, now for those of you who are still in this talk as kind of in, you know, as you're investigating a hypothesis, here's what I want to say. Remember the assumptions? There is God, he loves his creatures, fallen and entrapped as they are, but he went so far as to ransom them by giving them his own son for their release. Do you not think that if there is a God like that, that he would not also want others to come into that knowledge and freedom? And wouldn't he do that through the new community that belong to each other through his stone, through Jesus? Sounds like the completion of a circle to me. It seems coherent. It seems to make sense. But I want to finish up with what well may be a stumbling block to some of you. This last part could well be the thing that leaves you cold. I think it's important though, because unless you get this, I'm not sure that you will have got Jesus. Did you notice that if your hope is in Jesus, under each point, direction, belonging, contribution, there's a massive contrast made at each point. With direction, there is a contrast made with those which those studying social inquiry will love. Verse 18. You are ransomed, here's the contrast, from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors. The only reason there can be social inquiry is because we're social beings. We live according to the patterns and the habits and the values and beliefs of those important people around us. That's why there are such things as trends and movements and so forth. See, we all think we're free, but really all of us live by a social script. Just how it is. Even the decision to abandon your parents' ways is kind of just a reaction to this. You're being controlled by the script still. Just in reaction to it. And the contrast Peter makes here is that there is another script, another story written by God, a story of ransom by God in Jesus. And to be caught up into his story, God's story, means seeing your former life as empty, as futile. If you're not a Christian today, do you see your life as empty? Do you perceive your current lifestyle as futile? Chances are that in some degree you do. And that might actually be precisely the reason you're here. Because you're looking for hope. But this empty way of life is not just a subjective reality. It's objective. Remember, every single person will have to give an account before God one day, the impartial judge. So if you haven't been lifted out of the social script into God's ransom story, you haven't got with the program yet. Sorry, that's just the way it is. It is futile, friends, to live for yourself. You must live for God. The contrast in belonging, the contrast to hope, is made in the image of grass. And this is brutal, but it's obvious. All people are like grass. It withers, and all its glory dies. If you find your belonging just with other people outside of Christ, one day death is going to tear that sense of belonging away. They will die, and so will your sense of belonging, or you will die. but by belonging to God in Christ, imperishables. Death does not destroy those relationships with his family. Like Christ got a glorious body in resurrection, so too we will share with what Christ has one day. And we will live with all those who belong to him. And then finally, under contribution, there's a great contrast that's made with identity. Once you were not a people, it's a nothing. Once you were zero. Really? Well, your identity was probably caught up with maybe your image, your grades, your type of work, your choice of study. But now, he says, now if you don't find Christ a stumbling block but precious, then you're a people. A people with a massive contribution to making God's world for his glory. And just to remind us once more that this new identity happens because of Jesus, he adds, and once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. You are a people of God. Hope lives in Jesus, friends. Hope lives in Jesus because he takes us from futility to fruitfulness by giving us a weighty, worthy direction in life. The only weighty, worthy, truly worthy direction in life. He takes us from futility to fruitfulness by enabling us to belong in the family of God with others who are also in him, and also by giving us, as his people, useful things to do in his world, to making a contribution, to seeing his blessing go forth into every part of society and our globe. So if you haven't, do come to the living stone. To Jesus, won't you? And if you have, do keep coming to Jesus, the living stone. Because as you keep coming to the living stone, it's then that as a living stone yourself, you can be built into the very fabric of God's purposes for his world.